Then he stayed on at Urengard a while longer to accompany Simon on a hunt for a vicious bear that had killed some of the livestock in the mountain pastures. When Erland returned from the hunting expedition, there was a message for him. Some of his men had gotten into trouble with the townspeople, and he had to hurry north to win their release. Lavrans had business up there too, and so he decided to ride along with his son-in-law. It was already nearing the end of St. Olav's Day by the time they reached the island. Erling Vidkinson's ship was anchored offshore, and they met the regent at Vespers in St. Peter's Church. He went back to the monastery with them, where Lavrans had taken lodgings. There he dined with them, sending his men down to the ship for some particularly good French wine, which he had brought along from Nidaros. But the conversation waned as they sat drinking. Erland was lost in his own thoughts. His eyes sparkled as they always did when he was out on some new adventure, but he seemed distracted as the others talked. Lavrans merely sipped at his wine, and Sir Erling had fallen silent.
"You look tired, kinsman," Erland said to him.
Yes, they had encountered stormy weather near Hustastadvik the night before. He hadn't gotten any sleep.
"And now you'll have to ride swiftly if you're going to reach Tunsberg by St. Lavrans Day. I doubt you'll have much peace or comfort there either. Is Master Paul with the king now?"
"Yes." "Are you thinking of coming to Tunsberg?"
"If I did, it would have to be to ask the king whether he'd like to send filial greetings to his mother,"
Erland laughed,
"or whether Bishop Audfinn wants to send word to Lady Ingebjörg. Many are surprised that you're heading for Denmark, just as the chieftains are gathering for a meeting in Tunsberg," said Sir Erling. "Yes, isn't it odd how people are always surprised by me? Maybe I have a mind to see some of the folk customs I haven't seen since I was last in Denmark. Maybe even participate in a tournament. And our kinswoman has invited me after all. No one else in her lineage here in Norway wants anything to do with her now, except Munan and myself."
"Munan?" Erling frowned. Then he laughed and said, "Is there so much life left in the old boar? I'd almost thought he wouldn't have the energy to move his bulk about anymore. So Duke Knut is organizing a tournament, is he? And is Munan going to join in the jousting?"
"Yes. It's too bad, Erling. You can't come along to see it."
And Erland laughed as well.
"I can see you fear that Lady Ingebjörg has invited us to this christening ale, so that we might brew a different kind of ale and invite her in. But you know very well that I'm too heavy-footed and too light-hearted to be used in making secret plans. And from Munan, you've yanked out every tooth."
"Oh, no, we're not afraid of secret plans from those quarters either. Ingebjörg Håkon's daughter must have realized by now that she squandered all rights in her own country when she married Knut Porsche. It would be unwise for her to set foot inside the door here after giving her hand to that man, when we don't want to see even his little finger within our boundaries."
"Yes, it was clever of you to separate the boy from his mother," said Erland gloomily. "He's still only a child, and now all of us Norwegian men have reason to hold our heads up high when we think about the king whom we have sworn to protect."
"Be quiet," said Erling Vidkinson in a low, dejected voice. Surely that's not true." But the other two could see from his face that he knew it was true. Although King Magnus Eiriksson might still be a child, he had already been infected by a sin which was unseemly to mention among Christian men. A Swedish cleric, who had been assigned to guide his book learning while he was in Sweden, had led him astray in an unmentionable manner. Erland said, "People are whispering on every estate and in every house around us in the north that Christchurch burned because our king is unworthy to sit in St. Olav's seat. In God's name, Erland, I tell you it's not certain this is true. And we must believe that the child, King Magnus, is innocent in God's eyes. He can surely redeem himself. And you say that we have separated him from his mother? I say that God punishes the mother who deserts her child the way Ingebjörg has deserted her son. And do not put your trust in such a woman, Erland.
Keep in mind that these are treacherous people you're now setting off to meet. I think they've been admirably loyal toward each other. But you speak as if letters from Christ himself were floating down into the lap of your robe every day. That must be why you've decided that you dare to be so bold as to provoke a fight with the highest authorities of the church. Now you must stop, Erlan. Talk about things that you understand, my boy, but otherwise keep quiet. Sir Erling got to his feet. They were both standing up now, angry and red in the face. Erlan grimaced with disgust. If an animal has been mistreated, we kill it and toss the corpse into a waterfall. Erlan, the regent gripped the edge of the table with both hands. You have sons yourself, he said softly. How can you say such a thing? And you'd better watch your tongue, Erlan. Think before you speak in that place where you're now going. And think about it 20 times over before you do anything. If that's how you act, you who rule over the affairs of the kingdom, then it doesn't surprise me that everything has gone awry. But I don't think you need to be afraid, Erlan sneered. I doubt that I'll do anything. But what a splendid thing it has become to live in this country. Well, you have to set out early in the morning. And my father-in-law is tired. The other two men remained sitting there without speaking after Erlan had bid them good night. He was going to sleep aboard his ship. Erling Vidkunsson sat and turned his goblet around and around in his hand. Are you coughing? He asked, just for something to say. Old men catch cold easily. We have so many ailments, dear sir, which you young men know nothing about, said Lavrans with a smile. They sat in silence again, until Erling Vidkunsson said, as if to himself, Yes, everyone thinks the same, that it doesn't bode well for this kingdom. 6 years ago in Oslo, I thought it was clear that there was a firm desire to support the crown. Among the men who were born to this task by virtue of their lineage, I was counting on that. I think back then your perception was correct, sir. But you yourself said that we're accustomed to rallying around our king. This time he's merely a child, and he spends half his time in another country. Yes. Sometimes I think nothing is so bad that it's not good for something. In the past, when our kings frolicked around like stallions, then there were enough fine colts to choose from. Our countrymen simply had to select the one who was the best fighter. Lavrans gave a laugh. Yes, well. We spoke 3 years ago, Lavrans Lagmansson, when you returned from your pilgrimage to Skurvd and had paid a visit to your kinsmen in Jotaland. I remember, sir, that you honored me by seeking me out. No, Lavrans. You need not be so formal. A little impatiently, Erling threw out his hands. It was as I said, he continued gloomily. There's no one here who can unite the nobles of this country. Whoever has the greatest hunger forces his way forward. There's still some food in the trough. But those who might attempt to win power and wealth in an honorable manner, as was done in the time of our fathers, are not the ones who come forward now. That seems to be true. But honor follows the banner of the chieftains. Then men must think that my banner carries with it little honor, said Erling dryly. You have avoided everything that might have won you renown, Lavrans Lagmansson. I've done so ever since I became a married man, sir, and that was at a young age. My wife was sickly and had little tolerance for the company of others, and it looks as if our lineage will not continue to thrive here in Norway. My sons died young, and only one of my brother's sons has lived to be a man. Lavrans regretted that he had come to speak of this matter. Erling Vidkunsson had endured great sorrow of his own. His daughters were healthy children and had grown to adulthood, but he too had only been allowed to keep a single son, and the boy was said to be in poor health. But Sir Erling merely said, And you have no close kinsmen from your mother's lineage either, as I recall. No. No closer than the children of my grandfather's sister. Sigurd Lodensen had only two daughters, and they both died giving birth to their first child, and my aunt took hers to the grave with her. They sat in silence again for a while. "Men like Erlen," said the regent in a low voice. "They're the most dangerous kind. Men who think a little farther than their own interests, but not far enough. Don't you think Erlen is just like an indolent youth?" He slid his wine goblet around on the table with annoyance. "But he's intelligent, isn't he? And of good family and courageous. But he never wants to listen to any matter long enough to understand it fully. And if he bothers to hear a man out, he forgets the first part before the discussion comes to an end." Lavrans glanced over at the other man. Sir Erling had aged a great deal since he had last seen him. He looked careworn and weary. He seemed to have shrunk in his chair. He had fine, clear features, but they were a little too small, and he had a pallid complexion, as he always had. Lavrans felt that this man, even though he was a knight with integrity, who was wise and willing to serve without deceit, never sparing himself, fell somewhat short in every way as a leader. If he had been a head taller, he might have won full support more easily. Lavrans said quietly, "Sir Knut is also clever enough that he would realize, if they're contemplating any kind of incursion down there, that he wouldn't have much use for Erlund in any secret council." "You're rather fond of this son-in-law of yours, aren't you, Lavrans?" said the other man almost crossly. "If truth be told, you have no reason to love him." Lavrans sat running his finger through a puddle of spilled wine on the table. Sir Erling noticed that his rings were quite loose on his fingers now. "Do you?" Lavrans looked up with a little smile. "And yet, I think that you too are fond of him." "Well, God knows. But I swear to you, Lavrans, Sir Knut has plenty of things going through his mind right now. He's the father of a son who is the grandson of King Håkon. Even Erlen must realize that the child's father has much too broad a back for that poor young nobleman ever to get around it. And his mother has all the people of Norway against her because of this marriage." A little while later, Erling Vidkunsson stood up and strapped on his sword. Lavrans had politely taken his guest's cape from the hook and was holding it in his hands, when he suddenly swayed and was about to collapse, but Sir Erling caught him in his arms. With difficulty, he carried the man, who was heavy and tall, over to the bed. It wasn't a stroke, but Lavrans lay there with his lips pale blue, his limbs weak and limp. Sir Erling raced across the courtyard to wake up the hostile priest. Lavrans felt quite embarrassed when he came to himself again. Yes, it was a weakness that occurred now and then, ever since an elk hunt 2 winters before, when he had gotten lost in a blizzard. That was evidently what it took for a man to learn that his body was no longer youthful, and he smiled apologetically. Sir Erling waited until the monk had bled the ill man, although Lavrans begged him not to take the trouble, because he would have to leave so early in the morning. The moon was high, shining above the mountains of the mainland. The water lay black below, but out on the fjord, the light glinted like flecks of silver. Not a wisp came from the smoke vent holes. The grass on the rooftops glittered like dew in the moonlight. Not a soul was on the one short street of the town as Sir Erling swiftly walked the few paces down to the king's fortress, where he was to sleep. He looked strangely fragile and small in the moonlight, with his black cape wrapped tightly around him, shivering slightly. A couple of weary servants, who had sat up waiting for him, tumbled out of the courtyard with a lantern. The regent took the lantern and sent his men off to bed. Then he shivered a little again as he climbed the stairs to his chamber up in the loft room. Chapter 7. Just after St. Bartholomew's Day, Kristin set off on the journey home in the company of a large entourage of children, servants, and possessions. Lavrans rode with her as far as Hyrdken. They went out into the courtyard to talk,
he and his daughter, on the morning when he was to head back south. Sunlight sparkled over the mountains. The marshes were already crimson, and the slopes were yellow like gold from the alpine birches. Up on the plateau, lakes alternately glittered and then darkened as shadows from the big, glossy, fair-weather clouds passed overhead. They billowed up incessantly, and then sank down between distant clefts and gaps amid all the gray-domed mountains and blue peaks, with patches of new snow and old snowdrifts which encircled the view far into the distance. The small grayish-green fields of grain belonging to the traveler's hostel looked so strange in color against the brilliant autumn hues of the mountains. The wind was blowing, sharp and brisk. Lavrans pulled up the hood of Kristen's cloak, which had blown back around her shoulders, smoothing out the corners of her linen wimple with his fingertips. "It seems to me your cheeks have grown so pale and thin back home on my manor," he said. "Haven't we taken good care of you, Kristen?"
"Yes, you have. That's not why..."
"And it's a wearisome journey for you with all the children," said her father.
"Yes, well, it's not because of those five that I have pale cheeks."
She gave him a fleeting smile, and when her father cast a startled and inquiring glance at her, she nodded and smiled again. Lavrans looked away, but after a moment he said,
"If I understand rightly how matters stand, then perhaps it will be some time before you return to Gudbrandsdal?"
"Well, we won't let 8 years pass this time," she said in the same tone of voice. Then she caught a glimpse of his face. "Father! Oh, father!"
"Hush, hush, my daughter."
Involuntarily, he gripped her arm to stop her as she tried to throw her arms around him.
"No, Kristen."
He took her hand firmly in his and set off walking beside her. They had come some distance away from the buildings and were now wandering along a small path through the yellow birch forest, paying no attention to where they were going. Lavrans jumped over a little creek cutting across the path and then turned around to offer his daughter a helping hand. She saw, even from that slight movement, that he was no longer agile or spry. She had noticed before but refused to acknowledge it. He no longer sprang in and out of the saddle as nimbly as he once had. He didn't race up the stairs or lift heavy things as easily as he had in the past. He carried his body more rigidly and carefully, as if he bore some slumbering pain within and was moving quietly so as not to arouse it. His blood pulsed visibly in the veins of his neck when he came home after riding his horse. Sometimes she noticed a swelling or puffiness under his eyes. She remembered one morning when she came into the main house, and he was lying on the bed, half-dressed, with his bare legs draped over the footboard. Her mother was kneeling in front of him, rubbing his ankles.
"If you're going to grieve for every man who is felled by age, then you'll have much to cry about, child," Lavrans said in a calm and quiet voice. "You have big sons yourself now, Kristen. It shouldn't surprise you to see that your father will soon be an old man. Whenever we parted in my younger days, we didn't know any better back then than we do now, whether we're destined to meet again here on this earth. And I might live for a long time yet. It must be as God wills, Kristen."
"Are you ill, father?"
she asked in a toneless voice.
"Certain frailties always come with age," her father replied lightly.
"You're not old, father. You're only 52.
"My own father didn't live this long. Come and sit down here with me."
There was a sort of grass-covered shelf beneath the rock face, which leaned out over the stream. Lavrans unfastened his cape, folded it up, and pulled his daughter down to sit beside him. The creek gurgled and trickled over the stones in front of them, rocking a willow branch that was lying in the water. Lavrans sat with his eyes fixed on the blue and white mountain far beyond the autumn-tinged plateau.
"You're cold, father," said Kristen. "Take my cloak."
She undid the clasp, and then he pulled a corner of the cloak around his shoulders, so it covered both of them.
He slipped his arm around her waist. You must know, my Kristen, that it's an unwise person who weeps at another's passing. Christ will protect you better than I. No doubt you have heard this said. I put all my faith in God's mercy. It's not for long that friends are parted. Although at times it may seem so to you now, while you're young. But you have your children and your husband. When you reach my age, then you'll think it's been no time at all since you saw those of us who have departed. And you'll be surprised when you count the winters that have passed to see how many there have been. It seems to me now that it wasn't long ago that I was a boy myself. And yet it's been so many years since you were that little blonde maiden who followed me everywhere I went. You followed your father so lovingly. May God reward you, my Kristen, for all the joy you have given me.
Yes, but if he should reward me as I rewarded you.
Then she sank to her knees in front of her father, took his wrists, and kissed his hands, hiding her face in them.
Oh, father, my dear father.
No sooner was I a grown maiden than I rewarded your love by causing you the most bitter sorrow. No, no, child. You mustn't weep like this. He pulled his hands away and then lifted her up to sit beside him as before. I've also had great joy from you during these years, Kristen. I've seen handsome and promising children growing up at your knee. You've become a capable and sensible wife. And I've seen that you've grown more and more accustomed to seeking help where it can best be found, whenever you're in some difficulty. Kristen, my most precious gold, do not weep so hard. You might harm the one you carry under your belt, he whispered. Do not grieve so. But he could not console her. Then he took his daughter in his arms and lifted her onto his lap, so he was holding her as he had when she was small. Her arms were clasped around his neck, and her face was pressed to his shoulder. There is one thing I have never told another mother's child except for my priest. But now I'll tell it to you. During the time of my youth, back home at Skog, and in the early years when I was one of the king's retainers, I thought of entering a monastery as soon as I was old enough. Although I hadn't made any kind of promise, not even in my own heart, and many things pulled me in the opposite direction. But whenever I was out fishing on Botten Fjord and heard the bells ringing from the brothers' cloister on Hoveder, then I would think that I was drawn most strongly there. When I was 16 winters old, father had a coat of mail made for me from Spanish steel plates covered in silver. Rickard, the Englishman in Oslo, made it. And I was given my sword, the one I've always used, and the armor for my horse. It wasn't as peaceful back then as it was during your childhood. We were at war with the Danes, so I knew I would soon have use for my splendid weapons. And I didn't want to lay them aside. I consoled myself with the thought that my father wouldn't want his eldest son to become a monk, and I had no wish to defy my parents. But I chose this world myself. And whenever things went against me, I tried to tell myself that it would be unmanly to complain about the fate I had chosen. For I've realized more and more with each year that I've lived, there is no worthier work for the person who has been graced with the ability to see even a small part of God's mercy than to serve him and to keep vigil and to pray for those people whose sight is still clouded by the shadow of worldly matters. And yet I must tell you, my Kristen, that it would be hard for me to sacrifice, for the sake of God, that life which I have lived on my estates, with its care of temporal things and its worldly joys, with your mother at my side and with all of you children. So a man must learn to accept, when he produces offspring from his own body, that his heart will burn if he loses them or if the world goes against them. God, who gave them souls, is the one who owns them, not I. Sobs shook Kristen's body. Her father began rocking her in his arms as if she were a small child. There were many things I didn't understand when I was young. Father was fond of my brother Osman too, but not in the same way as he loved me. It was because of my mother, you see. He never forgot her, but he married Inga because that was what his father wanted. Now I wish I could still go to my stepmother here on Earth and beg her to forgive me for not respecting her goodness.
But you've often said, Father, that your stepmother never did much for you, either good or bad, said Kristen in between sobs.
Yes, God help me. I didn't know any better. Now it seems to me a great thing that she didn't hate me and never spoke an unkind word to me. How would you like it, Kristen, to see your stepson favored above your own son, constantly and in everything?
Kristen was somewhat calmer now. She lay with her face turned so that she could look out at the mountain meadow. It grew dark from an enormous gray-blue cloud passing in front of the sun. Several yellow rays pierced through, and the water of the creek glinted sharply. Then she broke into tears again.
Oh no. Father, my father. Will I never see you again in this life?
May God protect you, Kristen, my child, so that we might meet again on that day, all of us who were friends in this life, and every human soul, Christ and the Virgin Mary and Saint Olav and Saint Thomas, will keep you safe all your days.
He took her face in his hands and kissed her on the lips.
May God have mercy on you. May God grant you light in the light of this world and in the great light beyond.
Several hours later, as Lavrans Björgolfsson rode away from Hyrtgen, his daughter walked alongside his horse. His servant was already a good distance ahead, but Lavrans continued on slowly, step by step. It hurt him to see her tear-stained and despairing face. This was also the way she had sat the whole time inside the guest house, as he ate and talked with her children, bantering with them and taking them onto his lap, one after the other. Lavrans said softly,
"Do not grieve any more for whatever you might regret toward me, Kristen. But remember it when your children are grown, and you don't think they behave toward you or their father in a way you consider reasonable. And remember, too, what I told you about my youth. You're loyal in your love for them, that I know, but you're most stubborn when you love most. And there is obstinacy in those boys of yours. That much I've seen," he said with a little smile.
At last, Lavran said that she had to turn around and go back.
"I don't want you to walk alone any farther away from the buildings."
They had reached a hollow between small hills, with birch trees at the bottom and heaps of stones on the slopes. Kristen threw herself against her father's foot in the stirrup. She ran her fingers over his clothing and his hand and his saddle, and along the neck and flank of his horse. She pressed her head here and there, weeping and uttering such deep, pitiful moans that her father thought his heart would break to see her in such terrible sorrow. He jumped down from his horse and took his daughter in his arms, holding her tight for the last time. Again and again he made the sign of the cross over her and gave her into the care of God and the saints. Finally he said that now she would have to let him go. And so they parted. But after he had gone some distance, Kristen saw that her father reined in his horse, and she realized that he was weeping as he rode away from her. She ran into the birch grove, raced through it, and began scrambling up the lichen-gold scree on the nearest hillside. But it was rocky and difficult to climb, and the little hill was higher than she thought. At last she reached the top, but by that time he had disappeared among the hills. She lay down on the moss and bearberries growing on the ridge, and there she stayed, sobbing, with her face buried in her arms. Lavrans Björgolfsson arrived home at Jörungard late in the evening. A feeling of warmth passed through him when he saw that someone was still awake in the hearth room. There was a faint flicker of firelight behind the tiny glass window facing the gallery. It was in this building that he always felt most at home. Ronfrid was alone inside, sitting at the table with clothes to be mended in front of her. A tallow candle and a brass candlestick stood nearby. She got up at once, greeted him,
put more wood on the hearth, and then went to get food and drink. No, she had sent the maids off to bed long ago. They had had a hard day, but now enough barley bread had been baked to last until Christmas. Paul and Gunstein had gone off into the mountains to gather moss. While they were talking about moss, would Lavrans like to have for his winter surcoat the cloth that was dyed with moss, or the one that was heather green? Orm of Moar had come to Jorungarr that morning, wanting to buy some leather rope. She had taken the ropes hanging in the front of the shed and said he could have them as a gift. Yes, Orm's daughter was a little better now. The injury to her leg had knit together nicely. Lavrans answered her questions and nodded while he and his servant ate and drank. But he was quickly done with eating. He stood up, wiped his knife on the back of his thigh, and picked up a spool of thread that lay at Ronfrid's place. The thread had been wound around a stick with a bird carved into both ends. One of them had a slightly broken tail. Lavrans smoothed out the rough part and whittled it down so the bird had a stump of a tail. Once, long ago, he had made many of these thread spools for his wife. "Are you going to mend them yourself?" he asked, looking down at her sewing. It was a pair of his leather hose. Ronfrid was patching the inner side of the thighs, where they were worn from the saddle. "That's hard work for your fingers, Ronfrid." His wife placed the pieces of the leather edge to edge and poked holes in them with an awl. The servant bade them good night and left. The husband and wife were alone. Lavran stood near the hearth warming himself, with one foot up on the edge and his hand on the smoke vent pole. Ronfrid glanced over at him. Then she noticed that he wasn't wearing the little ring with the rubies, his mother's bridal ring. He saw that she had noticed. "Yes, I gave it to Kristen," he said. "I always meant it to be hers, and I thought she might as well have it now." Then one of them said to the other that they ought to go to bed. But Lavran stayed where he was, and Ronfrid sat and sewed. They exchanged a few words about Kristen's journey, about the work that had to be done on the farm, about Romborg and about Simon. Then they mentioned again that they should probably go to bed, but neither of them moved. Finally, Lavrans took off the gold ring with the blue and white stone from his right hand and went over to his wife. Shy and embarrassed, he took her hand and put on the ring. He had to try several times before he found a finger it would fit. He put it on her middle finger, in front of her wedding ring. "I want you to have this now," he said in a low voice, without looking at her. Ronfrid sat motionless, her cheeks blood red.
"Why are you doing this?"
she whispered at last.
"Do you think I begrudge our daughter her ring?"
Lavrans shook his head and gave a little smile.
"I think you know why I'm doing this."
"You've said in the past that you wanted to have this ring in the grave with you," she said in the same tone of voice, "and no one but you was to wear it."
"And that's why you must never take it off, Ronfrid. Promise me that. After you, I want no one else to wear it."
"Why are you doing this?"
she repeated, holding her breath. Her husband looked down into her face.
"This spring, it was 34 years ago that we were married. I was an underage boy. During all of my manhood, you have been at my side, whenever I suffered grief, and whenever things went well. May God help me. I had such little understanding of how many troubles you had to bear in our life together. But now it seems to me that all of my days, I felt it was good that you were here. I don't know whether you believe that I had more love for Kristen than for you. It's true that she was my greatest joy, and she caused me the greatest sorrow. But you were mother to them all. Now I think leaving you behind will hurt me the most when I go. And that's why you must never give my ring to anyone else, not even to one of our daughters. Tell them they must not take it from you. Perhaps you may think, wife, that you've had more sorrow than joy with me. Things did go wrong for us in some ways. And yet I think we have been faithful friends,
And this is what I have thought, that afterwards, we will meet again in such a manner that all the wrongs will no longer separate us, and the friendship that we had, God will build even stronger.
Ronfrid lifted her pale, furrowed face. Her big, sunken eyes burned as she looked up at her husband. He was still holding her hand. She looked at it, lying in his, slightly raised. The three rings gleamed next to each other. On the bottom, her betrothal ring, next her wedding ring, and on top, his ring. It seemed so strange to her. She remembered when he put the first one on her finger. They were standing in front of the smoke vent pole in the hall back home at Sunbu, their father's with them. He was pink and white, his cheeks were round, hardly more than a child. A little bashful as he took a step forward from Sir Bjergulf's side. The second ring he had put on her finger in front of the church door in Gerderu, in the name of the Trinity, under the hand of the priest. With this last ring, she felt as if he were marrying her again. Now that she would soon sit beside his lifeless body, he wanted her to know that with this ring, he was committing to her the strong and vital force that had lived in this dust and ashes. Her heart felt as if it were breaking in her breast, bleeding and bleeding, young and fierce. From grief over the warm and ardent love which she had lost and still secretly mourned, from anguish, joy over the pale, luminous love which drew her to the farthest boundaries of life on this earth. Through the great darkness that would come, she saw the gleam of another, gentler sun, and she sensed the fragrance of the herbs in the garden at World's End. Lavrun set his wife's hand back in her lap and sat down on the bench a short distance away, with his back against the table and one arm resting along the top. He did not look at her, but stared into the hearth fire. And yet her voice was quiet and calm when she once again spoke.
"I did not know, my husband, that you had such affection for me."
"I do," he replied, his voice equally calm. They sat in silence for a while. Ronfrid moved her sewing from her lap onto the bench beside her. After a time, she said softly,
"What I told you that night, have you forgotten that?"
"I doubt that any man on this earth could forget such words. And it's true that I myself have felt that things were no better between us after I heard them. But God knows, Ronfrid, I tried so hard to conceal from you that I gave that matter so much thought."
"I didn't realize you thought so much about it."
He turned toward her abruptly and stared at his wife. Then Ronfrid said,
"I am to blame that things grew worse between us, Lavrans. I thought that if you could be toward me exactly the same as before that night, then you must have cared even less for me than I thought. If you had been a stern husband toward me afterwards, if you had struck me even once when you were drunk, then I would have been better able to bear my sorrow and my remorse. But when you took it so lightly..."
"Did you think I took it lightly?"
The faint quaver in his voice made her wild with longing. She wanted to bury herself inside him, down in the depths of the emotions that could make his voice ripple with tension and strain. She exclaimed in fury,
"If only you had taken me in your arms even once. Not because I was the lawful Christian wife they had placed at your side, but as the wife you had yearned for and fought to win. Then you couldn't have behaved toward me as if those words had not been said."
Lavrans thought about what she had said. "No. Then, I don't think I could have. No."
"If you had been as fond of your betrothed as Simon was of our Kristen."
Lavrans didn't reply. After a moment, as if against his will, he said softly and fearfully,
"Why did you mention Simon?"
"I suppose because I couldn't compare you to that other man," Ronfrid said,
confused and frightened herself, although she tried to smile.
"You and Erland are too unlike each other."
Lavrans stood up, took a few steps, feeling uneasy.
Then he said in an even quieter voice, God will not forsake Simon.
Have you never thought that God had forsaken you?
Asked his wife. No.
What did you think that night as we sat in the barn? When you found out at the very same moment that Kristen and I, the two people you held dearest and loved the most faithfully, we had both betrayed you as much as we possibly could.
I don't think I thought much about it, replied her husband.
But later on, continued his wife, when you kept thinking about it, as you say you did.
Lavrans turned away from her. She saw a blush flood his sunburned neck. I thought about all the times I had betrayed Christ, he said in a low voice.
Ronfrid stood up, hesitating a moment before she dared go over and place her hands on her husband's shoulders. When he put his arms around her, she pressed her forehead against his chest. He could feel her crying. Lavrans pulled her closer and rested his face against her hair.
Now, Ronfrid, we will go to bed, he said after a moment.
Together they walked over to the crucifix, knelt, and made the sign of the cross.
Lavran said the evening prayers, speaking the language of the church in a low, clear voice, and his wife repeated the words after him. Then they undressed. Ronfrid lay down on the inner side of the bed. The headboard was now much lower, because lately her husband had been plagued with dizziness.
Lavran shoved the bolt on the door closed, scraped ashes over the fire in the hearth, blew out the candle, and climbed in beside her. In the darkness they lay with their arms touching each other. After a moment, they laced their fingers together. Ronfrid Iversdottir thought it seemed like a new wedding night, and a strange one. Happiness and sorrow flowed into each other, carrying her along on waves so powerful that she felt her soul beginning to loosen its roots in her body. Now the hand of death had touched her too, for the first time. This was how it had to end, when it had begun as it did. She remembered the first time she saw her betrothed. At that time, Lavrans was pleased with her, a little shy, but willing enough to have affection for his bride. Even the fact that the boy was so radiantly handsome had irritated her. His hair hung so thick and glossy and fair around his pink and white downy face. Her heart burned with anguish at the thought of another man who was not handsome nor young nor gentle like milk and blood. She was dying with longing to sink into his embrace and drive her knife into his throat. And the first time her betrothed tried to caress her. They were sitting together on the steps of a loft back home, and he reached out to take one of her braids. She leaped to her feet, turned her back on him, white with anger, and left. Oh, she remembered that nighttime journey, when she rode with Trond and Tordis through Jörndal to Dovre, to the woman who was skilled in sorcery. She had fallen to her knees, pulling off rings and bracelets, and putting them on the floor in front of Fru Asil. In vain she had begged for a remedy, so her bridegroom might not have his will with her. She remembered the long journey with her father and kinsmen and bridesmaids, and the entourage from home, down through the valley, out across the flat countryside, to the wedding at Skog. And she remembered the first night, and all the nights afterward, when she received the clumsy caresses of the newly married boy and acted cold as stone, never concealing how little they pleased her. No, God had not forsaken her. In his mercy, he had heard her cries for help when she called on him, as she sank more and more into her misery, even when she called without believing she would be heard. It felt as if the Black Sea were rushing over her. Now the waves lifted her toward a bliss so strange and so sweet that she knew it would carry her out of life. Talk to me, Lavrans, she implored him quietly. I'm so tired.
Her husband whispered, Venite ad me, omnes qui laborate, et onerati estis. Ego reficiam vos, the Lord has said. He slipped one arm under her shoulder and pulled her close to his side. They lay there for a moment, cheek to cheek. Then she said softly, Now I have asked the Mother of God to answer my prayer, that I need not live long after you, my husband. His lips and his lashes brushed her cheek in the darkness, like the wings of a butterfly. My Ronfrid. My Ronfrid. Chapter 8 Kristin stayed home at Husaby during the autumn and winter with no wish to go anywhere. She blamed this on the fact that she was unwell. But she was simply tired. She had never felt so tired before in all her life. She was tired of merriment and tired of sorrow. And most of all, tired of brooding. It would be better after she had this new child, she thought, and she felt such a fierce longing for it. It was the child that would save her. If it was a son and her father died before he was born, he would bear her father's name. And she thought about how dearly she would love this child and nurse him at her own breast. It had been such a long time since she had had an infant, and she wept with longing whenever she thought about holding a tiny child in her arms again. She gathered her sons around her as she had in the past, and tried to bring a little more discipline and order to their upbringing. She felt that in this way she was acting in accordance with her father's wishes, and it seemed to give her soul some peace. Sarah Eiliv had now begun to teach Nokva and Bjørgulf reading and Latin, and Kristin often sat in the parsonage when the children went there for lessons. But they weren't very eager pupils, and all the boys were unruly and wild except for Gauta, and so he continued to be his mother's lap child, as Erland called him. Erland had returned home from Denmark in high spirits around All Saints' Day. He had been received with the greatest honor by the Duke and by his kinswoman, Lady Ingeborg. They had thanked him heartily for his gifts of furs and silver. He had ridden in a jousting tournament and hunted stag and deer. And when they parted, Sir Knut had given him a coal-black Spanish stallion, while Lady Ingeborg had sent kind greetings along with two silver greyhounds for his wife. Kristin thought these foreign dogs looked sly and treacherous, and she was afraid they would harm her children. And people all around were talking about the Castilian horse. Erland looked good on the back of the long-legged, elegantly built horse. But animals like that were not suited to this country, and only God knew how the stallion would manage in the mountains. In the meantime, wherever he went in his district, Erland would buy the most splendid of black mares, and he now had a herd that was beautiful in appearance at any rate. Erland Nikolausen usually gave his horses refined foreign names, such as Belkalor and Bayard, but he said that this stallion was so magnificent that it didn't need any further adornment, and he named it simply Sultan. Erland was greatly annoyed that his wife refused to accompany him anywhere. He couldn't see that she was ill. She neither swooned nor vomited this time, and it was not even visible that she was with child. And by constantly sitting indoors, brooding and worrying over his misdeeds, she had grown weary and pale. It was during the Christmas season that fierce quarrels erupted between them. But this time Erland didn't come and apologize for his bad temper, as he had in the past. Until now, whenever they had disagreements, he had always believed that he was to blame. Kristin was good, she was always right. If he felt uncomfortable and bored at home, then it must be because it was his nature to grow weary of what was good and right if he had too much of it. But this summer he had noticed more than once that his father-in-law had sided with him and seemed to think Kristin was lacking in wifely gentleness and tolerance. It occurred to him that she was overly sensitive about petty matters and reluctant to forgive him for minor offenses which he had committed with no ill intent. He would always beg her forgiveness after taking time to reflect, and she would say that she forgave him. But afterwards he could see that it was simply stored away, not forgotten. So Erland spent much time away from home. and now he often took his daughter Margaret along with him. The maiden's upbringing had always been a source of disagreement between him and his wife. Kristen had never said a word about it, but Erlon knew quite well what she and others thought. He had treated Margaret in all respects as his lawful child, and whenever she accompanied her father and stepmother, everyone received her as if she were. At Romborg's wedding, she had been one of the bridesmaids, wearing a golden wreath on her flowing hair. Many of the women didn't approve, but Lavrans had persuaded them, and Simon had also said that no one should voice any objection to Erlon or say a word about it to the maiden. The lovely child was not to blame for her unfortunate birth. But Kristen knew that Erlon planned to marry Margaret to a man of noble lineage. He thought that with his present position, he could succeed in arranging it, even though the maiden had been conceived in adultery, and it would be difficult to gain for her a position that was firm and secure. It might have been possible if people had been convinced that Erlon was capable of preserving and increasing his power and wealth. But although he was well-liked and respected in many ways, no one truly believed that the prosperity at Husaby would last. So Kristen was afraid that it would be difficult for him to carry out his plans for Margaret. Even though she was not particularly fond of Margaret, Kristen felt sorry for the maiden and dreaded the day when the girl's arrogant spirit might be broken. If she had to settle for a match that was much poorer than what her father had taught her to expect, and for circumstances that were quite different from what she had grown up with. Then, around Candlemas, three men came from Formo to Husaby. They had skied over the mountains to bring Erlon troubling news from Simon Andresen. Simon wrote that their father-in-law was ill, and that he was not expected to live long. Lavrans wanted to ask Erlon to come to Seal, if he could. He wanted to speak to both of his sons-in-law about how everything should be arranged after his death. Erlon cast surreptitious glances at his wife. She was heavy with child now, her face was thin and quite pale, and she looked so unhappy, as if she might cry at any moment. Now he regretted his behavior toward her that winter. Her father's illness came as no surprise to her, and if she had been carrying such a secret sorrow, he would have to forgive her for being unreasonable. Alone, he would be able to travel to Seal quite swiftly, if he skied over the mountains. But if he had to take along his wife, it would be a slow and difficult journey. And then he would have to wait until after the weapons ting during Lent, and call meetings with his deputies first. There were also several meetings and tings that he would have to attend himself. Before they could leave, it would be dangerously close to the time when she would give birth, and Kristen couldn't stand the sea, even when she was feeling well. But he didn't dare think about her not being allowed to see her father before he died. That evening, after they had gone to bed, he asked his wife whether she dared make the journey. He felt rewarded as she wept in his arms, grateful and full of remorse for her unkindness toward him that winter. Erlon grew gentle and tender, as he always did whenever he had caused a woman's sorrow, and then was forced to see her struggle with her grief before his eyes. And he gave in to Kristen's proposal with reasonable patience. He said at once that he wouldn't take the children along. But Kristen replied that Nokva was old enough now, and it would be good for him to witness his grandfather's passing. Erlon said no. Then she thought that Ivar and Skula were too young to be left in the care of the servant women. No, said Erlon. And Lavrans had grown so fond of Gauta. No, said Erlon again. It would be difficult enough, as things now stood with her, for Ronfrid to have a nursemaid on the estate while she was tending to her husband on his sickbed, and for them to bring the newborn home again. Either Kristen would have to leave the child with foster parents on one of Lavrans' farms, or she would have to stay at Urengard until summer. But he would have to travel home before then. He went over all the plans again and again, but he tried to make his voice calm and convincing. Then it occurred to him that he ought to bring a few things from Nidaros that his mother-in-law might need for the funeral feast. Wine and wax, wheat flour and paradise grains and the like. But at last they made their departure, reaching Urengard on the day before St. Gertrude's Day. But this homecoming was much different for Kristen than she had imagined. She had to be grateful that she was given the chance to see her father again. When she thought about his joy at her arrival and how he had thanked Erlan for bringing her, then she was happy. But this time she felt shut out from so many things, and it was a painful feeling. It was less than a month before she would give birth, and Lavrans forbade her from lifting a hand to tend to him. She wasn't allowed to keep watch over him at night with the others, and Ronfrid wouldn't hear of her offering the slightest help in spite of all the work to be done. She sat with her father during the day, but they were seldom alone together. Almost daily, guests would come to the manor, friends who wanted to see Lavrans Björgulfsson one last time before he died. This pleased her father, although it made him quite weary. He would talk in a merry and hearty voice to everyone, women and men, poor and rich, young and old, thanking them for their friendship and asking for their prayers of intercession for his soul, and hoping that God might allow them to meet on the day of rejoicing. At night, when only his close family was with him, Kristen would lie in bed in the high loft, staring into the darkness, unable to sleep because she was thinking about her father's passing and about the impetuousness and wickedness of her own heart. The end was coming quickly for Lavrans. He had held on to his strength until Romborg gave birth to her child, and Ronfrid no longer needed to be at Formo so often. He had also had his servants take him over there one day so he could see his daughter and granddaughter. The little maiden had been christened Ulvild. But then he took to his bed, and it was unlikely he would ever get up again. Lavrans lay in the hall of the high loft. They had made up a kind of bed for him on the high seat bench, for he couldn't bear to have his head raised. Then he would grow dizzy at once and suffer fainting spells and heart spasms. They didn't dare bleed him anymore. They had done it so often during the fall and winter that he was now quite lacking in blood, and he had little desire for food or drink. The handsome features of his face were now sharp, and the tan had faded from his once fresh complexion. It was sallow like bone, and bloodless and pale around his lips and eyes. The thick blonde hair with streaks of white was now untrimmed, lying withered and limp against the blue-patterned expanse of the pillow. But what had changed him most was the rough gray beard now covering the lower half of his face and growing on his long, broad neck, where the sinews stood out like thick cords. Lavrans had always been meticulous about shaving before every holy day. His body was so gaunt that it was little more than a skeleton. But he said he felt fine as long as he lay flat and didn't move. And he was always cheerful and happy. They slaughtered and brewed and baked for the funeral feast. They took out the bedclothes and mended them. Everything that could be done ahead of time was done now, so that there would be quiet when the last struggle came. It cheered Lavrans considerably to hear about these preparations. His last banquet would be far from the poorest to be held at Urengard. In an honorable and worthy manner, he was to take leave of his guardianship of the estate and his household. One day he wanted to have a look at the two cows that would be included in the funeral procession, to be given to Sira Eirik and Sira Solmun. And so they were led into the house. They had been fed extra fodder all winter long, and were as splendid and fat as cows in the mountain pastures around St. Olaf's Day, even though the valley was now in the midst of the spring shortages. He laughed the hardest every time one of the cows relieved itself on the floor. But he was afraid his wife was going to wear herself out. Kristen had considered herself a diligent housewife, and that was her reputation back home in Skåne. But she now thought that compared to her mother, she was completely incompetent. No one understood how Ronfrid managed to accomplish everything she did. And yet she never seemed to be absent for very long from her husband's side. She also helped to keep watch at night. "Don't think of me, husband," she would say, putting her hand in his. "After you're gone, you know that I'll take a rest from all these toils." Many years before, Lavrans Björgolfsson had purchased his resting place at the Friar's Monastery in Hamar, and Ranfrid Ivar's daughter would accompany his body there and then stay on. She would live on a corridor in